I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6'6" above sea level.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. A UN-backed report says famine is expected between now and May in the north of the Gaza Strip. The report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification says about half of Gaza's population is already facing catastrophic hunger. Declarations of famine are rare and require precise conditions to be met. These include a jump in mortality rates. The UN Secretary-General, António Guterres, gave his reaction to the report's findings.
This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded by the Integrated Food Security Classification System anywhere, anytime. This is an entirely man-made disaster, and the report makes clear that it can be halted.
The Israeli army says it killed 20 Hamas fighters, including the head of operations of the group's internal security force, during a major raid on Gaza's biggest medical facility. The military also detained dozens of people in Al-Shifa hospital. The IDF called on people in and around the area to evacuate immediately. Donald Trump's lawyers say the former US president can't obtain a multi-million dollar bond that would allow him to appeal against a judgment in his civil fraud case in New York. He now has to find almost $500 million in cash, or the New York state authorities can start seizing the billionaire's properties, Neda Taufik reports.
According to Donald Trump's lawyers, obtaining a bond has proven to be a practical impossibility after approaching roughly 30 such companies. Very few, they say, will even consider giving him a bond of that magnitude, and the others will not accept real estate as collateral. Mr. Trump had previously asked the court to be allowed to post a $100 million bond while he appeals against the judgment, but that was rejected. Prosecutors argued that there was a significant risk that without a full bond, Mr. Trump would attempt to evade enforcement of the judgment after an appeal.
The head of a UN-mandated fact-finding mission on Iran, Sarah Hussein, has told the BBC that it found what was described as the ingredients of crimes against humanity in the violent means used to put down recent mass protests.
We were particularly shocked to find the use of firearms such as AK-47s, which are not used for crowd control or protest, peaceful protests or law and order enforcement. They're to be used in combat. We found the use of paintball guns used at very short distances, shot directly into people's eyes. We found cases of hundreds of people, peaceful protesters, being blinded through these kinds of shootings. These are some of the reasons we've come to the conclusions that we reached.
Ms. Hussein said the mission had also received direct statements from women saying that they had been raped while in custody. BBC News. Kidnappers in Nigeria have abducted more than 100 people in two separate attacks in the northwestern state of Kaduna. On Sunday night, gunmen kidnapped 87 people in a community called Kajuru Station, while 16 others were earlier taken from a nearby village. Richard Hamilton reports.
Kidnappings by criminal gangs for ransom have become almost daily occurrences in Nigeria, especially in the north, with the authorities seemingly powerless to stop them. Earlier this month, more than 250 schoolchildren were seized in Kaduna. President Bola Tinubu has said he will empower the armed forces to tackle crime, but the abductions just keep coming. The perpetrators are rarely arrested and justifiably see kidnapping as a low-risk, high-reward business. This is despite the fact that in 2022, paying a ransom to free someone was made illegal.
Vladimir Putin has addressed a triumphant crowd in Moscow's Red Square, a day after he claimed a landslide presidential election victory. The rally marks the 10th anniversary of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. Mr. Putin told the crowd all occupied Ukrainian territories were now part of new Russia. At least 10 dead bodies have been removed from Pétionville, an affluent suburb of the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. Local witnesses said they didn't know the circumstances of the deaths, but spoke of an attack by armed criminals early on Monday. Gang violence continues unabated in Haiti. The last form of asbestos still in use in the United States has been banned after a 30-year campaign to get rid of the cancer-causing material. The Environmental Protection Agency hailed the ban of chrysotile asbestos as a milestone that would stop 40,000 Americans dying unnecessarily every year. 50 countries have imposed a total ban on all forms of asbestos. BBC News.
Hola y bienvenido. Are you interested in learning about poets who write in the Spanish language, then are translated into English and published in bilingual editions? On Monday, March 18th, at 7 o'clock p.m., the WORT Access Hour will be presenting a special program, Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish, discussing the ongoing process of translations, its similarities and differences, its joys and pitfalls. Host James P. Roberts and guest Diego Alegría will share examples of their favorite poets and how reading them has affected their own poetry. That's Shared Visions, Bilingual Poetry in English and Spanish on Monday, March 18th at 7 o'clock p.m. on the Access Hour.
Good afternoon and welcome to Madison Bookbeat on WORT-FM. This is your program on books with an edge or an angle about Wisconsin. I'm your host today, David Ahrens. Our guest today is Josh Shepard, the author of Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh is an assistant professor of media studies in the University of Colorado at Boulder and director of the Sound Submissions Project at the Library of Congress. He received his PhD from UW-Madison in 2013. Let me ask you, Josh, did you work with, was Bob McChesney here at that time?
So the book is actually in his series at the University of Illinois Press. He had already moved to the University of Illinois at that point, but I did work with Jack Mitchell, who was professor in journalism and was the first employee of NPR.
Employee number one, huh? I like this book because it's an origin story. I mean, we have these institutions to which we feel very aligned, but and sometimes we don't know where they came from. And it's an origin story about an institution that is, of course, great interest to me, and I assume our listeners, that is public radio, or more broadly, non-commercial radio. There are two parts to our discussion as we go forward. I'd like to get, how did we get here? And then the second part is, where are we going? Non-commercial radio didn't happen because someone signed a paper or pushed a button. What I learned from this book, it was a very long slog. And then, Josh, I'd like to get your thoughts on the on radio's future, or specifically public radio's future. What it will sound like, how will other media, particularly podcasting, play into this. But first, let me clarify terms. That is, when we talk about public radio, it's the shorthand for all forms of non-commercial radio. And that includes, of course, national public radio and the vast network of college and community stations such as WORT and our Monona station, WVMO. So let's begin at the beginning. The story begins more or less, I guess, in 1934 with the Communications Act. What was the effect of having the New Deal? The book, you know, sort of shouts out in the title, this was the shadow of the New Deal. What was the effect of the New Deal on the creation of public broadcasting?
Yeah, so thank you very much. the Communications Act was the culmination of several previous radio regulations that had responded to different limits and pressures, such as commerce, necessity for just how to manage the new technology. It had also responded to the different interests who were vying to utilize radio for their purposes. Going back to the 1900s, you had even like distance listeners. So you had hobbyists, or they called themselves amateurs, who had a stake, at least for a while, in radio before it was a one-to-many model with radio. It was closer to a walkie-talkie in the early days of radio. Of the regulatory period, you end up having educators and commercial broadcasters. And the commercial broadcasters had widely developed the infrastructure, the technical infrastructure for radio. They owned the wires through AT&T. They had the manufacturing at Westinghouse and GE. They had the talent from New York City and vaudeville and Tin Pan Alley with NBC Red and Blue. Red was New York and Blue was New Jersey. And they had the patents, and the patents were really crucially important. So when you hit the first regulation, major regulation in 1934, you have this culmination of what we might call a free market libertarian model, by which the infrastructure for the country was not developed by the country itself. It was developed by private interests who had staked such a deep claim that it was nearly impossible to work around them in public service. And so the Communications Act defines media, per se, very, sort of preposterously, as serving public interest. And this is one of the funny things about that statement, and the full term was public interest, convenience, and necessity, was that they defined public interest as what the public was interested in, which is like the most nebulous possible terminology for it. So when you get to 34, most of the infrastructure was simply handed to the private interests who actually already owned it in a lot of ways. And it had grown almost like the railroads, like from city to city through the wires. If you look at early radio wire maps, they're actually very similar to railroad maps from you know, decades previous. And they kind of made it easy on themselves, the senators, in the bill. But the thing was that public interest defined radio diversity, so a term that we find very important, of course, today, that they defined it in terms of the capacity for multiple corporations to have access to ownership of the wires.
So they tried to avoid a monopoly, but if it was entirely corporate, that's okay, but not one corporation. They didn't want RCA to own the whole thing.
Yeah, RCA was on track to hold a full monopoly at that moment, that's right. And so what happened was, of course, educational stations were largely fledgling. They were experimental and trial and error. They were classroom extension services that had no profit motive whatsoever, and consequently, they had no advertising dollars that were coming in. And so by 1935, with the regulation, over 70% of non-commercial stations had lost their licenses. And what the book's about, in the shadow of the New Deal, is the way that there was kind of a change in temperament by which, within the regulation and the landscape that was set, different forms of reform and advocacy emerge that try to work within the regulation, since it was basically unchangeable, and use the regulation to build an infrastructure for what we now consider to be non-commercial media.
So those early stations, were they university stations that provided educational programming, such as WHA?
Yeah, WHA is actually probably one of the two great exemplars of non-commercial media history. And I of course, spent some time in Madison for graduate school. And so I went through a lot of the papers there. And that was one of the beginnings of the whole project. I was looking at the WHA papers. So most early educational radio came out of distance learning initiatives, which don't emerge until the 1900s or teens. So think of farmers up in Baraboo or something at the time, and they need to hear tornado warnings or they want to hear the pork belly report for the day, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's kind of where it began, was just these public service announcements through this very new technology to reaching parts of the state that otherwise would not have had this information fast enough for their purposes. By 1920-21, with WHA, 9XM at the time, they realized they could actually just do instructional broadcasts. And this is roughly the same time that other stations have the same realization at universities. So between about 1920 and 25, you see distance learning initiatives, so correspondence classes essentially, mm-hmm. being broadcast live from universities to farmers who can't, after a full day of work, ride the horse 15 miles for an evening class. It really made it easier to extend educational services. So most educational broadcasts came out of universities and school districts. So some of the biggest experiments were also like out of Cleveland, Ohio, and they were reaching different parts of town. Other ones were in other urban areas that had received immigrant populations, and they wanted to take a paternalistic role in teaching ways of communicating within Taylorism or Fordism and working together on assembly mm-hmm. lines. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of multifarious way that education was defined, and it largely came out of universities and school districts.
Was there a contest or get a place on the dial? I mean, the FCC was created, or some federal body was created that gave stations a place, a frequency to work with. Was there a conflict between the non-commercial or university stations and commercial stations that were popping up and wanted that place on the dial?
Yeah, absolutely. Commercial stations were not really against education as a concept, mm-hmm. but at that moment they had what they called frequency scarcity, which was there was only AM, only a limited number of bandwidths per receiver, so early radio set, and per area. So you might have, you know, anywhere from 4 to 10 channels in a big city, and fewer than that in a town like Madison, maybe 3 or 4. And the commercial stations had figured out this advertising model by 1925. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of coveting the kinds of advertising funds that could come from that. And so within that limited spectrum, the terrain had been set for the technical mastery to be the grounds for the station, not public service. And the commercial stations had mastered that in ways that educational stations could not at that moment. And they gobbled up all the stations pretty much. And this created a kind of public-private distinction at first, by which there is almost an antinomy in the structure of not only who could have access to the airwaves, but a view of what the purpose of the airwaves were. And of course, in educational stations, they were pulling from this notion of equal access to education and nonprofit, which became to define non-commercial media.
Was there a organizing effort among these, I guess they were all university stations at the time, to keep their place on the dial, that they wanted to have a secure by governmental regulation or whatever to secure their place?
Yeah, before 1934, there were some trade groups that famously articulated why public service media deserved to be in non-competition with commercial broadcasters. So they would call those protected frequencies. They would argue uh-huh. for protected frequencies. It was even a bill introduced before 34, which failed, that would have kept them out of the same regulatory standards. And then when 34 hit, people were so shocked, even within the commercial networks, that they said, well, hold on a minute. We can't eliminate education to rural communities. This wasn't exactly the goal. We just want to make money, right? That would be the commercial angle. Mm-hmm. So a couple things happen. The first is that it galvanizes all kinds of sectors that were only marginally interested before. So you get the origins of philanthropic funding, and they begin to fund types of ways to obtain frequencies through best practices. And we could talk about that a little mm-hmm. more. And then besides that, you get a kind of a rhetoric that emerges about how media is purposive beyond utilization for commercial purposes. It's not just for entertainment. Its roots are actually in something more like Western Union and ship communication. So the origins of non-commercial radio are actually in commerce in a lot of ways, and were never in entertainment in the way that film emerged. You know, early film went to the Nickelodeons right away. Mm-hmm.
Were churches interested then? Interested in realizing that, hey, this is a powerful medium that we could spread the good word?
Yeah, churches were actually almost completely shut out of the regulation and were actually qualified with educational broadcasters as kind of like editorial applicants. So anyone with an opinion who wasn't just providing advertising was almost received as like a propaganda station, which just seems counterintuitive to say that, you know, students receiving education with propaganda initially. But yeah, churches, all kinds of different labor groups were shut out as well. And there was this possible model for it that it could be a communications medium beyond just advertising. And so the reformers begin to coalesce into how do we get allocations back, but then how do we also persuade people that this is important? And this gets into other interesting caveats, like how do we produce data to show that it works, stuff like that.
Let me just interrupt here and say this is Madison Bookbeat. I'm David Ahrens, and we're talking with Josh Shepard, and we're talking to him about his book, Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. And we're going through a bit of how did we get here, non-commercial radio, and then we'll get into how we approach the future. To give listeners, we're talking about sort of this very early public radio from the university, primarily from the universities. And school systems of most major cities have their own radio stations as well?
School systems did have their own radio stations. They were almost always connected to the university. So typically what would happen with educational media is that they would have a state mandate for compulsory education. So what that meant was that every student in the state had to receive equal education. And then when that happened, then they would produce a certain curriculum, and then the curriculum had to be facilitated, right? So what happened is a lot of, so if you were in Ohio, Columbus, Ohio would produce broadcasts for major cities through state funding. And then they would have to measure that, similar to like standardized tests, but with radio broadcasts. So, yeah, that's how it worked. But it usually did come out of a flagship university, and then eventually it did come out of even regional universities as well.
Yeah, when I was a kid growing up in New York in the 50s, every week we would put our heads down and the teacher would roll in a big radio, and we would listen to classical music for an hour or two. But that was, I guess, the New York City educational station. What do you think was the effect of the Cold War? And you know, you talk about this a bit towards the end of the book about the perceived educational deficit of the U.S. compared to the Soviet Union and how that drove the building radio infrastructure.
What happens is radio goes to war, of course, and becomes a propaganda device, an informational device during World War II. And as part of that, a lot of the educators who were learning how to make better broadcasts in the 1930s went to military, and they developed educational broadcasts for the Navy and for the Army, and they also started to work in Reconstruction. And so educational broadcasting becomes pretty well streamlined in the 1940s. And when the Cold War rolls around, it becomes clear that a public service model has the support of multiple government agencies. And so by then, it's a better type of broadcast. They're getting better at the aesthetics. They also are networking the stations better between each other. So Madison, of course, was then connected to Stevens Point, for example, and they had relays. And yeah, so I think in the Cold War, what happens is radio becomes a way to mitigate the reemergence of fascism, but it also becomes a counterpoint to the excesses of commercialism. And there's this like sense that the good of nation relies on more than simple advertising alone.
I want to read the remarks of Newton Minow. Some of you may remember this, what I realize a very unfortunate name, in that he was called Newt Minow, who was the head of the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, in 1961. He gave a speech to the National Association of Broadcasters in which he described television as a, quote, vast wasteland. And he describes the experience of watching television for a full day. And this is what he said. "You will see a procession of game shows, formula comedies, and totally unbelievable families, blood and thunder, mayhem, violence, sadism, murder, Western bad men, Western good men, private eye, gangsters, morgue violence in cartoons, and endlessly commercials, many screaming, cajoling, and offending, and most of all, boredom. True, you'll see a few things you'll enjoy, but they will be very, very few. And you think I exaggerate? I only ask you to try it." This was a speech to the Broadcasters Association. This speech had an enormous impact, didn't it? I mean, I think it shook up sort of the status quo. And the thing is that everybody already knew it. I mean, to me, it was like the Surgeon General saying just a few years later that cigarettes are bad for your health. Everyone knew it. But here you had a public figure who's in charge of the whole show, really, the FCC, saying that this is a wasteland. Did this feed into the next part of the act, the Public Broadcasting Act?
Yeah, Newton Minow is kind of a culmination of a series of successes in advocacy that happened after the Communications Act. The FCC is, of course, formed by the act. In 1934, and it deliberates, and people blame the FCC for a lot, but they had to, as a regulatory body, follow the rules that the Senate had set initially. Mm-hmm. But they themselves were not happy with the way that allocations had worked after 34. And there's kind of a little legacy about how that distributes between the New Deal and in the early 40s to Newton Minow, voicing a perspective about public good. So what happens is the advocates begin to structure their reform suggestions around the tenets of public interest. And what that leads to is producing of evidence that audiences do indeed learn from non-commercial media broadcasts or educational broadcasts. And part of that is tied up in the origins of public policy research. Then they begin to set up a series of regulatory wins, starting in 1952 with the Sixth Report and Order. And then in 58, there's something called the National Defense of Education Act. And then you get something in 62, which is called the Educational Television Facilities Act. And the audience is probably already falling asleep just by listening to the name.
Well, but these were also the result of the Cold War hysteria, is that we need to build up our defenses by educating our kids, and we need to use radio and television to do that. And in order to do that, we need to fund educational television. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a great point. Because at the time, it wasn't public media, it was education media. So its funding came from facilities maintenance. So the big key to the whole history of the advocacy was that they learned how to get money under the same reason that they have to build a public school in your neighborhood. Just think of just the building of the actual building. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the radio begins to take on this veneer that it's a kind of infrastructural service similar to a building. And so all the acts I just named mm-hmm. were ways to continuously fund it. And what happens in 67... thanks to an advocate FCC to some extent, is that they set it aside and give it its own financing. They break it from the government. They break it from education, which is one of the interesting parts of public media, is it's no longer tied to educational funding or institutions in 67. And they give it its own mandate as one degree of separation for funding through the Corporation of Public Broadcasting that then funds NPR, PBS, and affiliates through block grants. And so, yeah, the Public Broadcasting Act and the buildup through the war are very indebted to education. It really is an educational service with cultural uplift, like, you know, the origins of Masterpiece Theater is in NET Playhouse. Mm-hmm. You know, they have these like programs that are before that kind of quote unquote high culture mm-hmm. performance and Shakespeare mm-hmm. and stuff and Jane Austen. But they eventually become its own essentially private fourth network.
So with this came really the formation of the public radio network, now KNO, along with other upstarts like Pacifica Radio and then a few years later, WORT. Do these things follow?
So, you know, Pacifica emerges in the late 1940s. It's such a remarkable model, and it has so much better access in the community to talking to itself through media. That's really the beauty of the model, the community model, is that there are, of course, standards to get onto the radio, and you have to learn how it works and get your broadcast license. But beyond that, the gatekeeping function isn't limited to a perceived expertise that's granted by some kind of institution. So that has a kind of a parallel history. And when it hits the Public Broadcasting Act, community radio is actually offered a bigger stake and they turn it down within that funding model, but they are still qualifying for block grants, which is still a part of the system.
How come these stations occupy the left side of the dial? Is that sort of premeditated that, hey, we'll take all the public or non-commercial stations and make them 88, 89, 90?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think, you know, a lot of the clearest frequencies are in the middle of the dial. And so I think what happens is the educational stations and some of the more the newer stations that you see at the very high end of the dial, close to 1600 and FM, are getting weaker signals. And they were also later allocations. So the allocations as the dial expanded were then given as frequency scarcity was less of a problem and provided less competition. I think that's the explanation.
Radio broadcasters haggle over who gets 95 and who gets 107, or
yeah, there's a funny aspect to that that's very contemporary too. In that, you know, if stations don't follow certain procedures, they can't get renewals, and you have this kind of you have interest groups around that who are always vying for the stations that become available, and they will often report against stations at the FCC to try to get people to lose their licenses so that they can potentially grab the license that can't be renewed. This happens in AM dial quite a bit too with religious stations and educational and university stations. Is there's a kind of an active listenership that is in sort of an anti-listenership that is trying to find reasons to report stations. So yeah, there's all kinds of intrigue around the possible revenues that can be gained out of a station.
So it's been a long road. It's about 100 years now of, you know, non-commercial radio of some sort or another. So where are we at now? What do you think is the state of the art, the industry? It seems that listenership is down, and I heard that NPR cut its staff. Personally, radio is indispensable for me. You know, it's not just because I'm here talking on the radio, but just part of my life in the morning in the car and so on. But my kids, who are in their 20s and 30s, never listened to it. I mean, they grew up around it, and then at some point it went click. They listened to music streaming and podcasts. Is that where we're going, and what do you think is happening at this moment?
So, I mean, first, the big problem is that states stopped funding public media at some point pretty recently. The block grant structure to the CPB has not grown a tremendous amount. And frankly, I think it could have been a lot higher but the politics in D.C. made it a kind of complacency by which bigger requests were never really made, even when there seemed to be opportunities to do so in the 80s and 90s. So that, of course, and things are more expensive now. So as the inflation grows, that money is worth less as it's distributed. So that's one of the problems. And then you simultaneously, you get less investment from regional and localism, which used to actually fill in the gaps for some of how that would work. And so that has been filled in then by philanthropic groups, which has always been a part of the history. But then you actually are getting investments from some philanthropic groups that are against the public service mission and essentially want to privatize public media. I'm talking primarily about public here, more than community. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the donations, so I donate to my local Colorado station on a monthly basis. I have an auto charge, you know, given for that, for the community station. But they really need those pledges now in ways they hadn't before, but always did. And then you're looking at like a Koch brothers, rather preposterously becoming the savior of science programming out of WGBH or something like that. Mm-hmm. So on the other side, I think there's a lot of promising developments. So I think that low power FM and the ability for the community to use radio literally as a communications device to talk about local issues has been remarkable. The Prometheus Project has done a lot of good advocacy and lobbying work in that area.
And talk a bit about that. I'm not aware of Prometheus Project.
Sure. Yeah, so there's simply a lobby group that helps local communities obtain these tiny frequency licenses, you know, 100 watts, 300 watts, 500 watts, and they can then have anyone from the community get into the station who goes to the training. And so you'll have something, I'm not sure what it might be in Madison, because WORT does such a great job serving the community. That's what I listen to. But you go into places like around D.C., for example, where I lived for a while, and there might be one just for Tacoma Park, Maryland. It just reaches Tacoma Park, Maryland. And so Prometheus is just a lobby group that helps with the legalities of building transmitters, maintaining them, and keeping the licenses. But really, it's a bottom-up grassroots movement for local communication, more than local entertainment. And so I think that's been very promising over the last 10, 15 years. Also podcasting, you know, one of the stipulations of the mission statement for public media is that it kind of enriches society and has this educational purpose.
You mentioned at the end of your book, you mentioned the mission statement that was created at, I don't know, whenever NPR was created in 1960s or 1970, and it's a mission statement by Bill Simmering, who apparently was a maybe the first employee for WHA or whatever, but started NPR. So he wrote this mission statement, and after you wrote about it, I found other references to it. Can you read a bit about it? Do you have it available?
Well, I could pull it up. There's a few things to say about it. The most important thing for non-commercial media, and I think the community media is really the leader in this, even more than public media is sometimes, is that no audience is too small. Every possible demographic, as the commercial industry would say, deserves to have its voice heard and deserves to be spoken to. So what Bill Simmering is doing is he's taking that educational philosophy and applying it to the new service, and that leads to some of the genres that they have, like All Things Considered and stuff like that. So what I wanted to say quick about podcasting is that podcasting can then reach those small audiences in ways that appointment listening, so tuning in live, makes it difficult to deliberate about for a producer. You know, what do we really want to put on that show for 15 people or something like that of the community? And the podcasting allows for that possibility. So what Bill Simmering is a really interesting figure because he writes this piece as the founding program director, and it's called National Public Radio Purposes. And it becomes a kind of not just like local to the network philosophy, but it kind of spreads around the world as that there is a purpose to media that has to do with community and recognition beyond the simple reaching an audience or merely reaching an audience in ways that they might be amused by for short periods of time. And I think he even writes in his piece that you could read to allow for minority viewers to be unrepresented or misrepresented is to deny freedom of choice and threaten the life of democracy. So I think that that is one of the major concepts that underlie the purposes statement.
PISA, National Public Radio, will serve the individual. And part of that, I take it to mean that it's also, it's not to serve some marketing interest. And we'll celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied rather than vacuous and banal. And it will encourage a sense of active constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness. Those are very strong words for a federal, quasi-federal agency.
True. There's this moment, you know, it's NPR is a year after PBS. They finally get off the ground. And it is pulling from all of these Midwestern land-grant university philosophies. So you have like the Wisconsin idea, right, at Wisconsin, the Van Hise approach to reaching everyone in the state. And he literally was born of that. He's from Wisconsin. He taught grade school in Wisconsin, actually, Bill Simmering, before he was a DJ. So yeah, he really believes in this implementation of a kind of like a public project that had started in the 1920s and then taken 40-something years until they had a platform, a sustainable platform that didn't just require philanthropic funding and, you know, these ups and downs that come with state bureaucracies.
It's quite a statement of purpose. And I don't know if you've been on committees or organizations where you do mission statements. And, you know, this one's really the best. And it's really rather brief. And also, unlike most mission statements, it then has seven ways that we're going to do it. It's not just these are things we'd like to do, but then he gives seven sort of basic strategies and outcomes that he wants to get this thing done. You're listening to Madison BookBeat. I'm David Ahrens. I'm host this week for our program. And our guest today is Josh Shepard. He's the author of Shadow of the New Deal and The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Is it a victory, Josh? I mean, where is it continued to be a victory?
Yeah, so I have to admit that that was suggested by the press, the title. the logic was that, you know, the history that had been written had stated that the 1934 Communications Act that we talked about was this major defeat of democratic media. And then the history kind of stopped there, and no one had really done the deep dive into the archives to see what happened next. And what I found was that the same people in the literature that had worked up to 34 were the same ones who built the pillars for public broadcasting through a series of advocacy strategies that took decades afterwards. So that's it. So the victory is sort of out of the defeat. Educational media, we actually do get something that's not perfect. It needs work. It needs continuous attending to. But it's not merely a defeat, you know, because this activist network had really had a vision for equal access to education. And as you just stated with the Bill Simmering purposes statement, they went through logistics to succeed. And I think that's one of the key takeaways of what I was trying to get done in the book, which is that good activism isn't just making things clear and conspicuous. Okay, here's a problem. We should know about it. That's really important. It's a really important part of the political economy of activism. But it also is this very long, slow slog to build infrastructure, to understand logistics, to change policies and logistics. And I look at, you know, the different steps that it took and how long it took for there to be something that arose out of the ashes of the defeat of educators. And that's kind of like my sort of philosophy of good activism.
It too, becomes advocacy, as you say.
In the mechanics. Yeah.
So you say that it moves on to advocacy.
Yeah, I make a little sleight of hand in the book, which is that, you know, before 34, it's mostly lobby. They're just sort of saying, we want it to be this way. We want protective frequencies. And so I call that the activist period because they're talking about where it's failing public service. And then activism would translate into something more like either you win or you lose with your lobby. And then with advocacy, I make this argument that There's a system building approach as well, of which activism is a part. And so the advocacy statement is that building the groundwork so that something can sustain beyond the contradictions or crises at the moment in which it's being discussed. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of distinction I make. It's kind of like a more of a thought experiment. It's not like an objective statement of the difference between activism and advocacy. Sure. But I do want people to think about building things that sustain and then actually become permanent. And how does that happen, for better or worse?
From movements into organizations and institutions. Do you think that there's a convergence between social media and mass media, that YouTube and TikTok are really our carriers? We're watching different programs, but they're the major carriers or channels, the way CBS or NPR once was.
Yeah, at this point, in the academy, we call it legacy media. That's like television and radio. So radio is still the most utilized medium in the world, if you take every country and put it together, because the digital is not everywhere yet. It will be eventually through satellites. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that what we consider to be a public sphere has always been a contested concept. So what is a public? So, the early regulators thought that commercial broadcasting could serve as the effective public. The commercial consumer model was the democratic public. So I find that to be fallacious. I find that to be wrong. And then the educators thought public meant better access to information and education, which I would personally think is a better argument for a public, even in its failings at times. So as we move into the digital, of course, all of that has become blurred. And, people are so attuned to media constantly now that I think that we have something more like what we usually call like a remediation, by which these little pieces of these other concepts are still present. But even just like the models of communication have changed, and the models of identifying with a community have changed, because some people's communities are almost entirely online and they don't even meet face to face in some cases. Yeah, I think that these are being subsumed, and I think that will eventually affect PBS more than NPR. NPR has a little thing up its sleeve that also community radio has, which is local news. Mm-hmm. And I think that as the digital siphons eyeballs, away from television and just sitting down and watching television at certain times for a certain program, mm-hmm. There's, if you go to Panhandle, Nebraska, right, where I live now in Colorado, who is going to find it profitable to do local investigative journalism out there? There's very few people who live out there, but the local affiliate for commercial media and then the local community media stations will continue with that reporting. It's part of the mandate of those stations. Oh. So I think that's, and it's cheaper at the same time. So it's very sustainable. And so, yeah, I think that the digital will continue to undermine these, what they call legacy media, but that the localism will survive.
So to maintain the license, local radio stations have to do local reporting?
So to receive certain kinds of block grants through the CPB, public stations do have to attend some degree of localism, which includes these facilities maintenance things that are very boring but central to it that we talked about.
Yeah.
So yeah, commercial stations, the rules are a little bit different. They have to just prove that they're providing a stable service for a certain amount of time within the rules.
What we see now, I read that some of the high-end car manufacturers have removed AM radio from their cars, and that there was talk of further, elimination of AM radio. And there was some pushback to that, I think, particularly in rural areas. Is that the direction that we're headed?
Yeah. AM's frequencies aren't as, they go long, but they're not as crisp. So you get these really big ones like News Radio 78 in Chicago that you can hear in Pittsburgh even, on some days.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is more spotty and there's less investment in it. And the real killer is what you mentioned, which is that the digital can actually pick up a signal now. And if you have a satellite signal through one of the carriers like Sirius or XM, then you don't even really need certain transmitters anymore. You don't even need certain infrastructure. So the same stations can carry signals without those bands. So I think AM should survive. It's just, what does Josh think? I think that it's a service. I think it is especially important in rural areas. Also, a lot of religious communities have built conversations around the AM dial. It doesn't seem necessary to me to make these changes because of broader discourses and shifts in digital access. Seems to me like if it can be paid for, it should retain itself.
Do you think cars should be required, car manufacturers should be required to have it on their radio?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure personally what the decisions are around who's deaccessioning what for FM and AM stuff. But the answer is yes. It should. It's like almost like a form of censorship to remove different channels. And then, of course, my new car had Sirius and XM installed in it. And then it wants you to pay more money.
Right.
So instead of a free service at AM, they have a new subscription service that they want to require. And so I think that's the game there, is that there's some kind of investment in moving to subscription services instead of free, at least in terms of the corporate interests.
Right-wingers have their policy prescription for public radio, which I guess is simply to get rid of it. I don't have any doubt that if Trump and other fascists win in 24, that NPR would lose its funding. Do you think that's a serious threat ahead?
Yeah, I edit the history series at Current, which is the trade journal for public media for itself, with a colleague of mine, Mike Jansen. And I remember when Trump came in and said he was going to defund public media, that I was extremely concerned that that was the case. And he had been at the trade journal covering this for many years already. And he said, nah, it's not going to happen. And I didn't really understand why. But apparently there's just a huge number of things. It's not just the removal of funds, but new amendments that also have to be passed, number one. And number two, that local journalism thing is quite popular with the constituencies of a lot of congressmen. And so, like, for example, they give out an award in public media for, like, public servant most supporting of public media. And I think Mike Pence won one of the years before he was vice president, because he was in rural Indiana, you know, so they were really into the localism of the public affiliate in rural Indiana. So it seems like total defunding is rhetorical, because I think it would have already happened. They would have figured it out if they could have. And it would have had to have gone to appeal to the courts or something. There would have been a whole procedure that never got followed. Bush number two tried to defund it. Nixon, of course, famously wanted to defund it. This is like a part of the history, is the constant threat of the right, that the equal access to information is a threat to a kind of like white supremacist model, and it's a threat to a corporate model. But it also is, ironically, a threat to a populist model, because of the people who actually listen in different parts of the countries with over 1,000 affiliates. It's a complicated thing, though I think it'll be defunded. I think actually the bigger threat is to television. I think PBS is so expensive to maintain. And of course, PBS doesn't actually produce programming. That's part of its mandate. It's produced out of the affiliates. So it comes out of Boston, San Francisco, and Chicago, New York, and others. And I think that might eventually move to a streaming model if certain kinds of funding are either cut or are not sustained, that it becomes affordable and the pledges dry up. So I could see like a Nova just being a standalone streaming, you know, or a subscription model or something like that. But I think radio's actually very durable. And of course, if the digital infrastructure collapsed in some way for some reason, we have shortwave radio. It's actually sustainable beyond even certain technical failings with radio. So I think the answer is garbled, as my answer just.
We don't know.
In some ways, we could lose some parts of it, but other parts will actually stay strong.
So what are the national policy changes that you feel are needed to, as we look out to the future of this social legacy media mix-up?
So I think public media funding needs to increase substantially for it to be the service that it portends to be. So it actually did get some tens of millions increase under Biden very quietly. But I think it really needs to be at least doubled to serve true news analysis and coverage. We need at least $1 billion instead of 500-something million dollars. I also think that there's a little angle here, which I close the book with, that public media could follow, which is that the way it got funded well enough, at least for a lot of years, was this combination of university funding, because it was part of the university, the philanthropic funding that we're familiar with, largely Ford Foundation in the 50s and 60s, but then also its access to the educational sector. And of course, if the mandate for non-commercial media is the smallest possible audience without any advertising goals, right? So how do you fund media without income, right? It's like the sort of the paradox of this history in the U.S. context. The answer is, you know, every year education has an extremely diverse, renewable audience within the primary and public school, the secondary public school structure. And I think if it were to reconnect somewhat and produce programming or parts of curriculum, that it would actually qualify certain kind of partnerships and block grants again that could sustain it and increase its funding beyond its current model, which from what I can tell is to compete with commercial networks, which was never the purpose in the first place. So it has a very unique genre model and it has its own voice in U.S. public media, but it seems like it would only be able to fulfill its mission statement if it still counts by reconnecting with public education.
So what would that look like? I mean, would it look like teaching Spanish in the evening or, you know, the latest in soil enrichment, or what would that be? I mean, is it Nova?
Yeah, I mean,
is it Nova? I mean, that's obviously, you know, educational programming of some kind, but it's not specifically related to a curriculum.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, homework assignments, I mean, students are learning in different ways than linear reading, you know, so a left to right reading model is a certain kind of learning. And what we see is that there's lots of kinds of learning, all of which work in different ways. And I think listening is actually a really great learning model. So I mean, there could totally be curriculum that's developed, that's history, could be languages, that could be a part of the public media infrastructure, since it has this great talent within it that knows how to use the mic and knows how to, you know, keep the rhythms for listening going and has that conversational model. So yeah, I think that is one of the models. It's just simply produce curriculum within line of different requirements that are already within the educational system.
Yeah, so sort of Sesame Street for grade 2, 3, 4, 5 as I mean, not really Sesame Street, but something with high production values and a curriculum, basically.
Yeah, the first successful model is music appreciation. That was the first educational model that really struck with listeners.
Yeah, well,
when a lot of other instructional models, people were just reading into Mike's lessons and they didn't like it. That's one of the things about early educational media, is it wasn't very good. It got better, of course. And I think that, yeah, high quality music appreciation, they used to call it home economics, but it could be even like cooking, travel, these kind of things that people are fundamentally interested in that come out of educational models are pretty still viable within curriculum models through listening.
Well, that's what, you know, your music appreciation example, I mean, that's sort of what I gave as an example of listening to educational TV as a, you know, nine-year-old, I mean, educational radio. Well, I think we're out of time, and we've been listening to conversation with Josh Shepard, who's an author of Shadow of the New Deal, The Victory of Public Broadcasting. Josh, as I mentioned at the outset, is an assistant professor of media studies at University of Colorado at Boulder and director of Sound Submissions Project at the Library of Congress. He received his PhD from UW-Madison in 2013. Thanks for your time, Josh. This has been a really interesting discussion about the origins and future of non-commercial radio, something that we need to be mindful of.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Have a great day. And you've been listening to WORT on BookBeat. I'm David Ahrens, and our producer is Sholly Pittman. Thanks very much.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, March 20th at 7 p.m. virtually via Zoom. The public is welcome to attend. For instructions on how to attend this meeting, email president@wortfm.org.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, serving area businesses, nonprofits, and multi-dwelling properties with high-speed, net-neutral internet, digital phone, and television services. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 18th.
MetMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for March 18th. On March 17th, No Doubt released their self-titled debut album. I'm going to leave you dangling until the end to reveal the year. No Doubt formed on the coattails of second wave ska and shared the scene here in the USA with bands like Sublime, the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, and Less Than Jake. Early gigs often included covers of two-tone classics like Too Much Pressure by The Specials. The album was recorded for less than $13,000, and to promote it, No Doubt toured with Rage Against the Machine and Public Enemy. The track Trapped in a Box is about the power that the media has over our lives and how it can control one's mind. Although many tracks are built on a ska bass, the band brings the